Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. Well, today is Wednesday. It's July 8th and 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. We have a very exciting day today because we're going to be joined by none other than Gabrielle M. Etzel. She's the publisher, editor-in-chief of the Unvarnished blog. What we're going to be discussing today with her is the recent ruling with respect to the United States Supreme Court. And it is the Supreme Court that upheld what is called a faithless elector and the laws that pertain to a faithless elector. And so it's a very, very exciting issue and topic. And I think that what's so exciting about it is that how it was defined, the lead justice, or seemingly the justice that took the lead with the majority view, was none other than Justice Kagan. And so we'll review with Gabrielle her perspective on that. I see she's already on. Good morning. How are you?
I am wonderful, Hezzy. Always great to be with you early in the morning. How are you, sir?
Oh, absolutely. It's a great wake-up call for sure. Well, it's a pleasure to speak to you, Gabrielle. Really very exciting. You know, you picked a really great subject, and it didn't dawn on me because, like I'm saying, am I the only geek out there that's really interested in what the Supreme Court has to say? And evidently, no, I'm not the only one, so you're out there. Thank God for that. I don't feel as lonely as I felt before. So it's very interesting, this thing about the elector law that was passed down with a preponderance of the lead being taken by Justice Kagan. And I thought it would be more exact, actually, because she said that based on the numbers of people who are sworn to and take an oath, they take an oath to abide by the directive of those people that elected them to do that sort of job. But some of them don't follow through. So I was a little bit unnerved because, not because I didn't think that Kagan's concepts were legitimate or could be appropriate. I was just offended that it wasn't defined in exactly the form it should. In other words, if you swear, then you have to abide. And if you don't, then that should invalidate your vote. How do you look at it?
Well, first and foremost, I think it's important to review how the Electoral College works exactly. For anyone who doesn't fully remember, or is unaware, when we vote for the President of the United States, we're not actually voting directly for the President. We're voting for electors who are chosen by the states to represent the vote. They're usually pledged to a certain candidate. And it is said nowhere in the Constitution exactly whether or not the represented that electors actually have to abide by their promise. Now, after examining Justice Kagan's ruling and also Justice Clarence Thomas's concurring opinion, but using different reasoning, Kagan relies on mainly historical precedent, which is different than how I, for example, view the role of Supreme Court decision making. Should be more on the text of the Constitution itself, and then only relying upon historical precedent when there isn't much to go on in the direct text of the Constitution. But be that as it may, I'm more inclined to believe and to support Clarence Thomas's and Neil Gorsuch signed on with this the concurrence, which basically says that although there is nothing if it's for or against states implementing penalties on electors for not following through with their pledges, then there's no constitutional bearing to say whether or not we can prevent states from doing this. So
but you
I'm
know
more
what,
in line
what I
with
guess
that.
what offends yeah I concur with you as well. What I don't understand is why do we have a standard or a protocol where we're demanded to swear that we would follow through on our and our conduct is directed to us, and but it makes it seem that the Constitution, even though it's still a living and breathing edict or something that we live under, why is it so stagnant? Why is it just like stuck? Because there isn't enough to explain the purpose of it. We understand the purpose is to nominate the president, but if you're sworn to cast your vote for one individual, why should you be able to change that? And doesn't that also cause a distrust of the people that believed you would abide by the ruling? I mean, it's like, you know...
I completely understand your point, Hezzy, and there is a question that I voted for a specific elector, and now and you're not even voting for the name of the person, you're voting for the candidate to whom they're pledged, and all of a sudden they can change their mind. There is a little bit of outrage there, but I think that the fault is more in how we've designed the electoral system, how we design the electoral system at large, not within the Constitution itself and not within the system of the Electoral College itself. If you read, and it's always best to not read the Constitution alone, but to also read the historical documents that go along with the making and adoption of the Constitution.
Mm. Yeah.
So if you look at the constitutional debates regarding the election of the president over the specific period of time before the Constitution was fully formed, the framers of the Constitution discussed the election of the president 17 times. Specifically, they discussed the process of electors 9 times. So they thought about this process. They chose how to do this for a reason. And you and I have talked before about the canceling of the Electoral College, making this a popular vote. So but it was thought about. And if you go to Alexander Hamilton talks about the whole process of electing the president in Federalist Paper number 68, in which he, if I may quote it for a few moments, bear with me. It's long and complicated, but it is important. That the immediate election should be made by men most capable of analyzing the qualities adapted to the state in act and acting under circumstances favorable to deliberation and to a judicious combination of all the reasons and inducements which were proper to the governing of their choice. A small number of men selected by their citizens from a general mass will most likely possess the information and discernment requisite to such complicated investigations. So it close quote. So the framers of the Constitution were not small d Democrats in the sense that the masses should be electing people in should be electing officials directly. And they wanted to remove power from the hands of the masses, but still keep the people accountable. And so in effect, the whole Electoral College system is designed for the masses to vote for specific people to think about these types of issues and make their own judgments based upon their own conscience.
But then why do they swear to abide by their directive? And then I'm not saying that they're bad people in any way, but why do they have the option of changing? Because then it's like saying, well, I expect you to wash the dishes, and even though you promised you would do it, you haven't. Why? I mean, it's not such a big deal washing the dishes, but you know what I'm saying.
No, absolutely. And I think that this is more of a problem. If people are going to blame the Electoral College for this, I don't think that it's the Electoral College problem. It's the states who put on the types of requisites that individuals vote for specific people. that individual voters vote for specific electors who are pledged to certain candidates. If we were voting for representatives to go to the Electoral College and vote based upon their conscience, we wouldn't have this issue. But because states mandate that they have to pledge to a specific candidate, it's all about election rules and not actually about the Electoral College.
Right. So does that mean, though, that whenever these electors cast their vote for one person or the other, particularly if they cast their vote for someone that they promised they would, but they don't, can that switch the election from one individual to another?
It very rarely has. And very rarely has made a difference in the actual presidential race. The majority of our country's history in the so-called faithless electors happened in the 19th century and mainly dealt with vice presidential picks. And so it really had nothing to do with the full administration. So that's number one. In the 20th and 21st century, there have only been 15 faithless electors, according to the House of Representatives website. But seven of those were in the 2016 election. The majority were from, if I'm recalling correctly, Washington, the state of Washington, and Colorado. So that's another reason why that this is a major issue. And keep in mind that the Supreme Court case that came out on Monday only deals with states assigning penalties for faithless electors. There have been previous cases where where the Supreme Court has validated that states can make the right to force electors to pledge and make sure that they maintain their pledge, or stay honored to their pledge, but without an enforcement mechanism. So the Monday's case only deals with the enforcement mechanism. That's something.
So
to keep
you
in
mean
mind
that
as well.
Was really the only thing that the $1,000 penalty fee that they wanted to impose, and why would that rob one of their individual rights? And no penalty fee, then that would be okay?
It would be okay, and it is also okay for states to start instituting penalties because of the case on Monday. But and it wasn't just – so the state of Washington was, for faithless electors, was imposing a penalty of $1,000 fine. The state of Colorado, I believe there was only one gentleman who was a faithless elector in Colorado, and their punishment is to remove them from the office of holding an electorship. So so there are a variety of types of penalties that are now – covered because there was actually two Supreme Court cases that came down on Monday, but they're kind of combined.
Why do we have a penalty? Doesn't the penalty imply or infer that evidently there was misconduct of some form, however you want to define it, because someone did not follow through on their pledge? So we fine them, and is that sufficient? Is that the be all and end all? It's like saying, okay, you murdered somebody, we're going to fine you $1,000. Have a great day.
Well, I think it depends upon whether or not you consider going against your initial pledge a violation of any form of actual violation. Or any type of, not to compare it to an actual crime, but along those types of lines. Let's come up with a hypothetical example. There are hundreds of electors who are pledged to Joe Biden. So if there's, heaven forbid, Joe Biden after he wins the popular election on November 3rd, then he suffers a severe stroke. Okay. So
then what?
Heaven forbid. But exactly what do you do in that situation then? Would you punish an elector for saying I can't vote for a person who has gone through such a health crisis? I mean, make that an impetus to change your perspective as an elector.
Mm-hmm.
So there, you could imagine a multitude of cases where it would go against somebody's conscience, to an elector's conscience, to go with their initial pledge. Circumstances change, and then the nature of the office of the electorship is so that individuals can calmly and rationally, without being connected to mainstream politics, without being connected to the emotional elements of politics, as the majority of us citizens, myself included, are, then to allow for a deliberation process to make conscience a matter of electing the president.
Well, God forbid, let's say someone does suffer a stroke for whatever reason or some other debilitating situation, they really can't function. So the Electoral College really only is a vote cast for the president, not for the vice presidential candidate that's chosen by the president, even though we probably will know who each individual presidential candidate, such as Trump with Pence, we don't know yet Biden's actual choice, and there are a few people that are being considered. So should anything happen to the top guy or the top individual from their different party, should it go to the vice presidential candidate? Or do we have to hold a new election?
Believe it or not, this has happened in the past. It did happen in the 19th century, and that's where the majority of there are approximately, some sources differ depending upon who you read, but there are approximately 180 faithless electors in our history. And this exact situation did happen, where there, in the interim of an election, I believe he wasn't in the party that actually won the election, but the faithless electors had to choose a different candidate besides the popular vote. So, and it was for the vice presidential candidate who ran with them on the ticket. So it has happened, and it's something to consider. But it doesn't have to, but the faithless electors do not have to necessarily choose the vice presidential candidate that went with the supposed
right.
president or the running president. There's, I believe.
Uh-huh.
In 2016, there were several who voted, several Republican pledged electors who voted for John Kasich instead of Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
There were also several Democrats who also voted for John Kasich instead of Donald Trump. So it's a complicated process, and most importantly, the mainstream media isn't fully dealing with the nuances of this process, making it more of a deal than I think it actually has to be.
Uh-huh. Well, I guess I'm stuck because I like the definition, and I understand these different quirks in circumstance and in life can come about, but then I don't understand why we don't have a direction of what we're supposed to do at that point, so that it's strictly defined. And we all know exactly what the next step would be. God forbid somebody gets a stroke or they're debilitated to such an extent that they can't function as the president. Because I'm not comfortable with people who go outside of their pledge. If you didn't pledge, then okay. So I don't know why you got the position, but you got it for some reason. But if you don't follow a protocol, then the system to me fails, because I don't know what they're going to do, and why do I even have these people in between me and whoever I want to vote for president?
Well, that's something to keep in mind also, that we can debate whether or not we should abolish the Electoral College, and that's in some respects a different debate. But
yeah, it is different. I don't necessarily want to abolish it. You know, I think there needs to be a redefinition. Look, if you swear you wanted to vote for Hillary Clinton, fine. I don't have a grudge against that. But at the same time, those people that decided they were going to vote for Trump, they voted for Trump. So why should one candidate lose out to the other because somewhere along the line, for whatever reason, somebody decided to change the vote that they swore they would not go in that direction, and then they did anyway. So, that's where I lose it. Not in a bad way. I mean, I'm not going to freak out about it. But,
you're not going to fly. You're too
problem.
Rational to
I think
fly
there's
off
a problem
handle.
Because, yeah, well, I think there's a problem somehow because it's not to win an argument. There is no argument to win here. This is the law of the land, and, you know, I have to defer, you know, to the justice. She knows what she's talking about. She had a really good, solid argument. Even a different perspective that came to a similar conclusion. But I don't understand why we define things in every other way, but we don't define it here, even though it was studied.
For sure. And there are certain things. So the Constitution, it doesn't clarify everything, and it wasn't intended to clarify everything because it allows mm-hmm. for certain different circumstances that couldn't be foreseen. And so, okay. To a certain degree, we do have to rely upon history, and we do have to rely upon intention. And to a certain degree, the American people have become obsessed with the idea of democracy. A small d democracy where every individual voice, and it's a majoritarian rule to a certain degree, which is a completely different mindset than from what our system was designed to be. We were designed to be a small r republic, in which if individual citizens vote for representatives who act upon their best judgment, who act upon their conscience. It's amazing to me how the American people don't agree with or don't see the need for individual people acting based upon their conscience. But that's a whole separate matter. Mm-hmm. But we were designed more mm-hmm. of to be more of a Aristotelian type of society where there are certain people who are or are more capable of doing certain things than others. And mm-hmm. whether or not we agree with it, that's the type of system that we have. So before we can say that we need to change anything, or before I think changing things, we need to first understand what the nature of the beast actually is. So
I don't want to change anything, but you're right. These are standards that have worked for so many centuries. So there's some validity to it. I find it difficult because I don't really trust. Look, I can't even trust people who are in elected office to do what they promise they will do. So you vote for some bozo who at the end decides they want to go somewhere else. So, you know, it's not an enlightenment that you expect of them, because if they postulate a particular perspective on any one issue, then that's one of the reasons that you probably will vote for them. And if that is the main issue, and they don't abide by it, then what good is their word, and therefore what good is the system? So I don't know what we're getting by allowing people to either be fined or not fined, however it works, when they don't abide by their pledge. Then why do we have pledges? I don't see that. Because if we didn't have the pledge, then we could all do whatever we want.
Unfortunately, I think it's a fatal flaw in the way that states organize their elections. If people voted for electors who were quite frank and said, "Listen, this is the person that I support as of right now," but there could be a certain situation, whether it's the incapacity of a candidate
right.
or I'm pledged to Trump, but he gets us in the middle of a nuclear war, and I really don't support nuclear war. There are certain circumstances that could change my mind. I'm speaking as an elector. I do see a need for individuals for the individual elector system.
Well, that's a very valid point that you make. So, if something changes from now, where you would expect that a Democrat, someone who belongs to the Democratic Party, will vote for Biden. Someone who is a Republican will vote for the Republican. And I guess if you have a Democrat that tells you now that they want to vote for President Trump, that's fine too, or the other way around. And I don't have a problem with any of that. But then, should we then not define what could happen or if it does happen that therefore we are absolved of our pledge because, let's say, someone has become debilitated or because circumstances are such where the response of a particular individual is egregious and we don't want that? That's not what we're looking for. I think if you leave it be, I think that becomes a problem because then we don't know who to trust because it's just a lot of gobbledygook in my mind. I mean, that's what I see in a lot of our elected officials. They talk a good game. They say absolutely nothing. And then at the end of the day, we're the ones responsible for casting our vote one way or the other. And that's why we have a lot of the discord we have today.
Absolutely. And part of our problem, well, first of all, I will have to say that gobbledygook is the absolute best term that you could use for the majority of politics. And that's the first term the first formal definition that you learn when you're studying politics, that the majority of it is gobbledygook. So I love the language. But at the same time, this is part of. Oh, and I lost my train of thought for a moment. But this is part of our problem that we to a certain degree we've made too much of politics. We've put so, and this is part of the general problem of political culture in the United States right now. We have invested the majority of our livelihoods in political outcomes. I can't think of a facet of life except for what goes on inside your own body, inside what your own consciousness that isn't influenced, that isn't directed by politics. And so,
doesn't politics inform us everywhere? Everything that we can imagine is political.
But the question is,
the parties that actually brought us here. It's their fault. We didn't obsess with it. They did it. And now they don't want to live by it.
They feed off of each other. I think we feed off of each other. The electorate and the parties feed off of each other, and it's blown out of proportion to a certain degree. But there are certain things in life that shouldn't have to deal with politics. Raising a family shouldn't have any political bearing. How you educate your children really shouldn't have any.
Why did we politicize that? Why do we have laws for abortion, against abortion, certain other things that matter? It seems intrusive at that point, and we made it political. Everything is political, and it shouldn't be. And we don't have anybody who is smart enough to stand up and say, this is this. You've just politicized something that should not be political. Even like we had demonstrations because some police did really egregious things. They literally kill people when they didn't have a right to do that. They also took a pledge, and they didn't abide by it. But that's because I believe that a lot of them are not trained. So we make believe that they're trained. They don't have a clue. They don't even know the law, so many of them. And they just become, you know, powerful individuals because they have a gun. Or they've trained how to hurt people. But that's not good enough. But everything has become political. And then when people riot in the streets, that's political. You know, I even wonder if it's legitimate.
It's a very interesting question. It's a very difficult question, but we have to a certain degree, because we've made everything about politics. Whether it's there are certain things that do fall in the realm of political decision making, there are certain things that are inherent that need to be addressed from a political perspective of how because the only central question in politics is how do humans live together in a community without killing each other? That's the essential goal of politics, or should be the essential goal of politics. But it's critical. But if there are certain elements that we allow ourselves to make individually, then the majority of the problems go away. But to a certain degree, that's a little bit of a different issue. But we at this moment in time, I've said it before on this program, we're at a crossroads in this country. We need to decide exactly how we're going to go, which makes this election very important. But even more so than that, it makes individual lives important. How we are going to conduct ourselves, not just at the national level when we're pushing a button or we're filling in a paper circle, but at the smaller local levels and in the individual level as well.
Well, I concur with you wholeheartedly about that. I would love to be able to. I have only one voice. I guess it's ineffectual in the scheme of things. What do we have? 300 million people in this country. One voice is not going to cut it. But we don't seem to have a concerted effort to deal and contend with some of the stuff that is political and other stuff that should be segregated from the politics or separate from the politics. Maybe have equal standing on a different level, but just simply different. And so we don't have the leadership anywhere on the local level, on the national level, even on the international level. We don't have the leadership that allows us to even become immersed in that discussion. So in a sense, that's part of the dysfunction. And that's why the politics plays a big game, because the political voices are the ones that are directing the discussion, and they're not always upright, and they're not always forthright, and so much of it is deceptive. It sounds like I think everyone's doing the wrong thing. It's just that there's too much that is wrong, and it's not honest, and so it's a game, and we get played. Well, I don't get played that much, but but you know what I mean.
You're too wise for that, Hezzy. No. No, of course. In some respects, I'm at a loss for words, which isn't a good thing to happen on a talk radio show. But it's a monumental question. That how exactly do we get back to a society where we deal with things on a rational level, where we instead of delegating the majority of our decisions to political leaders, how do we take back individual responsibility for our own lives? That's a very profound question.
That's a very profound question, because it would cause people to be responsible for their life and their input to society, or their lack of input. And so everyone should have, in their own capacity, something to offer. And I think everyone does, but a lot of people shrink away from that, and then that becomes politics.
Absolutely. You said it the best possible way. It's very interesting to see. But to get back onto the topic mm-hmm. that we promised our listeners
right.
that we talk about today with the
electoral college.
We pledged it. We're going against our own. But I want to ask you, because believe it or not, it is your show, Hezzy. Do you think that the electoral that this change in the potential electoral college system of forcing electors to uphold their promises is going to have any impact on this 2020 election cycle? I have my opinion, but I want to hear yours.
Well, I think it probably won't, because as Judge Kagan mentioned, the number of people that switched was not even 0.5% of all the different cases where there was something that became right. questionable. So percentage-wise, I guess she's right. The only problem is you never know when there is the population is so rife with anger, and we've become so politicized. I think if you're a Democrat, you have to wonder if Democrats will support your candidate. If you're a Republican, if the Republicans will support your candidate. And what happens if one side decides to go to the other side? And doesn't that abrogate our relationship with our government when it's a one person, one vote? So undermine the whole of the Electoral College?
To a certain degree, it does. If you force electors to and now states have the right to add teeth to their decision, they're mm-hmm. forcing individuals to pledge. To a certain degree, it makes states able to force force their electors to pledge. But it also gives people, individuals to blame. It gives individual citizens a person to blame if there's something that goes wrong, I see the potential for a scapegoat. Now the question is, it's really interesting to see the fact that the Democrat and the Republican Party respectively are in two very different positions right now.
Mm-hmm.
If you compare,
yeah, they are.
Democrats have the majority of Democrats, or I don't believe, or especially young Democrats, don't have faith in Joe Biden. They don't see leader, and neither do you. And you've voiced this before, but
mm-hmm.
you voiced it today. But there's a total disconnect between the Democrat voters, especially young Democrat voters, and young Black Democrat voters for sure,
mm-hmm.
and their established party head. At the same time, we can see in the Republican Party there's if anybody has watched hasn't watched Trump's Mount Rushmore speech yet, I highly recommend it. It was an absolutely profound speech that I don't believe that there has been anything that has quite touched the core conservative base of the Republican Party since the early Tea Party movement, to be quite frank. Mm-hmm. Certain commentators have said that it is hateful and very divisive, and I saw none of that. I saw an individual, I saw a president who understood the plight of the American people, who understood the nuances of the time that we're living in, of the cancel culture and things of that nature, who was able to articulate the desire to be heard. Most importantly, that has been Trump's asset from the very beginning. He, even if it is just his advisors, understands what the forgotten man in America really wants and wants to be heard. So that was a profound element to this speech. But he also understood.
Go ahead.
He also understood that the history of and specifically referring to Mount Rushmore, but the desire for the preservation of American history and the preservation of uniquely American culture. So tying this back to the Electoral College just for a moment, if we see electors who go against their pledge to Trump, or we see electors who go against their pledge to Biden, those will produce two different effects. If we see electors go against their pledge for Trump, this it will have a significant effects on the Republican base to turn against members of the party who don't support Trump. But at the same time, if we see electors who pledge themselves to Biden and go for Biden, I could see that disrupting the Democratic Party to a certain degree for being faithful electors and not representing the real Democratic will of the part of that particular party. So there are two different sides to this point.
Yeah, I guess there would be. To be honest with you, it's come to the point where I realize that we get a lot of fluff and a lot of innocuous terms and just, I don't know, gobbledygook, I guess, is the best. You know, I've spoken to some people in high positions. They can't give you a straight answer on anything. And you really wonder why, at least, well, I don't wonder why. It just seems that, again, for them, it's all political game. It's all photo opportunities, whether you verbalize it or whether you get a photo snapshot with something that you've done. Innocuous things that they do, and yet somehow or another we fawn over it. But the reason we fawn over it is because the political system demands it. We're either on this side of the fence or on the other side of the fence, and one can't be balanced. There are a lot of things that one can say is that maybe Democrats of the old are correct, or maybe the new Democrats are correct. But then at the same time, on the Republican side, there are other issues that are correct and maybe some that aren't. I don't know how we've divided ourselves to such an extent where now we're at each other's throats. But that's been permitted, I think, more by Wall Street than anything else. It's the big power that decides who gets paid what. And it's not working. You know, there was a time when it was more fair, you know, probably in the 50s and 60s, where everybody earned a living, or most people did, and then all of a sudden things changed. And now there are a lot of people who are totally destitute, even though they're working. Go figure on that one. That means they're not getting paid enough. So I don't know. It's just that there are no answers, but it's just a very, very big divide. And I don't know who's going to come out to vote this year. I don't know who's energized.
I don't know if anybody is going to be coming out to vote, but they might be staying in to vote, unless they're going out to vote, they'll have their masks on and be social distancing. Mm-hmm. But in all seriousness, you're absolutely right. To a certain degree, this election is profoundly important because it illustrates the need for us to either continue on a more reasonable path, a more reasonable path, and more a more sustainable path, or if we are going to abandon the project, abandon this American project altogether. If we're going to abandon the idea that men can live together, hopefully not. I don't think so. But it to a certain degree, if you have no faith in your election system, then you can't have any faith in your government. If you don't have any faith in how you choose your representative, even if it's a monarchy, if you have no faith in that specific mechanism of how you choose your governorship, then there's no way that you can possibly have faith in the laws that they produce. So that's really the question when it comes to this election. It's more important than just which side wins. It's systemic.
Well, I find one of the biggest problems with the political divide right now is that the people who stand before us, whether Republican or Democrat or vice versa, however you want to look at it, the bottom line is at the end of the day, they don't explain their vision. They don't validate their vision. They don't, in reality, explain what they're going to do about a particular circumstance. So I don't know why we would think that certain segments of our society are being represented well by a Republican as opposed to a Democrat, or why we think they're being represented by a Democrat and not by a Republican. When I thought people were people, and there should be a way to ameliorate the ills of their existence because the control mechanism is with government. And that's a system that we may not have had 200 some odd years ago, 300 years ago. But the point is, we've turned it. It's been morphed into what it is today. And we're at a powder keg. And I don't know why.
The question is, my question really should be then, is it the fault of the elected officials who don't convey their positions, who don't actually explain any of the problems, who pay us lip service, or is it the American people themselves who are really to blame because we don't want to hear it? We don't want to actually listen, whether it's a more leftist perspective that wants to give entitlement programs and help people that way, or if it's the right who believe in tax cuts are the way to help people. We really don't want to hear the fact that we're XYZ billion dollars in debt and we can't afford either one. We don't want to hear the actual problems anymore. I think that's more of the problem. We instinctively, because we don't want to hear the problems, choose people who will give us lip service. We don't choose the honorable people who will tell it like it is anymore. That's our real problem.
I think you're right. You're really on target with respect to that. So then I guess it still boils down to what I think is the panacea of it all is, I guess, we could have Trump running and we have Biden running, and whoever wins, they can always turn the other in another direction and take a leadership role and define for us in very, very succinct language exactly why we're heading where we're heading and why we shouldn't do what may have been done in the past. And I don't know if that's just pie in the sky and it's never going to come about. But then I don't know where the leaders are or if they're all torn apart and controlled by their party, but they're not controlled by what their heart and their mind are telling them. And so does that mean that if you're going to be honest with the American public, whether it be on the city level, the municipal level, or on the national level, state level, you're not going to win because you're being honest or forthright?
Well, I will say something with respect to that. I see a little glimmer of hope to a certain degree, and I'm trying to be as unbiased as possible, but I seriously, for anybody who really wants to get to the heart of this issue, I really strongly recommend listening to the entirety of Trump's Mount Rushmore speech last weekend. Because he really gets to articulate these points. He kind of provides what we're searching for, a clearer vision, and to a certain degree he articulates more of what he's against than what he's for, but he still articulates what he wants to see. So and I absolutely love when our president stays on script, but because he has some of the best speech writers but and then objectively speaking, but if we there is a glimmer of hope there, whether or not it's complete lip service, but in actual speech, I'm not entirely sure. But if you look at it as it's very interesting to compare the presidency of Donald Trump versus the presidency of Barack Obama. Barack Obama was a very articulate person and was able to speak eloquently and speak eloquently off the cuff. I'll give him that. But President Trump is more of a doer. If you look at his actions, ignore the majority of his words as he speaks off the cuff. But if you look at his actions, he does try to do what he promised. He's at least he's trying. Which is difficult to say in this day and age, but if we're seriously looking for a answer to what should be done, if we're looking for, even if we disagree with it, if we're looking for somebody with a vision, then I go back and watch that speech.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think it's so difficult to say. I think there are many issues that he brings up, President Trump, that are valid. I think they're invalidated by people who have a perspective and a political agenda. So, I know there are a tremendous amount of people that are coming across the border that they're not all South Americans or Central Americans. They come from Asia. They come from Africa. And you mean to tell me that nobody recognizes the difference between one people or another, even just by the color of their skin or the fact that they speak different languages other than Spanish? You know, I mean, so much is stupid. It's gotten to the point where you really wonder, like, how literate are some of the people who are reporting for us? And that becomes a problem, at least to me. And then such ignorance on the part of so many people who are covering the politics. I don't know where they've been. Where did they go? Maybe they were born in New York City, but they lived in Brooklyn, or they lived in the Bronx, or they lived in some other little place that had nothing to do with anything else around the world, and they don't know what it's like in Brazil or in Peru or in Argentina, or any place in Africa, or any place in Asia. There's a problem with that. It's ignorance speaking all the time. And you can't tell me when, like, even when, like, so they're asking questions now, should people who are illegal, should they also get medical coverage? On what basis should they be getting medical coverage? I remember when I was in the travel business, and we had a tremendous amount. I was an expert on Africa and South America for travel. I knew how to get from here to there, and many places that were like off the beaten track, literally hard to get to. But I remember we were flying people from New York via Lisbon to Kinshasa, which at that time was called Zaire when I was in the business. Now it's called the Democratic Republic of Congo, and we found that I was getting a tremendous amount of travel that way. But then all of a sudden, after about a year of being in that market from New York to Africa, we started to get an influx of people buying tickets from Kinshasa. And I didn't have any question about it. There was really no problem with it. But then I realized close to a year later where people returned their tickets and wanted a refund for the other half. which I had no problem in refunding. They had paid for it. I would get it back from the airline, so it wasn't a loss of any kind. But then I realized, why is this happening? A question like, why do things happen? And the reason it happened is because a lot of people who didn't have the means or the capacity for medical treatment decided to come to America, and they stayed here, overstayed their time, or they came in on a visitor's visa, and guess what? They had heart surgery, they had this, they had that, and the thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars on the back of the American public. Now, I don't begrudge them to do that, but the point is, we can't afford to pay for the world. And that becomes a problem. And that's why we look the way we do, because so much is spent abroad. And when I contacted the American Embassy, I said, what's wrong with you guys? How come you're allowing this? Oh, well, we don't know what to do. Great, good for you. And at the end, I was shocked. At the end, I just abandoned the route. And I said, I'm sorry, I'm just not going to deal with it. I didn't want to touch it anymore. We had a lot of other traffic with Air Portugal, so it didn't matter to me. That was not my main concern. But it just goes to show you what happens. I remember there were some people from Reuters who were covering people coming in through Mexico into Texas, or however they crossed into the United States. And they would say things like, oh, they're not Arab. Oh, really? I said, if you've been here for 30 or 40 or 50 years, you think that you don't speak Spanish or Portuguese? Really? I mean, are you that stupid? Okay, well, evidently you are. So those are the same people that if you would look at them, you could probably be able to figure out what ethnic background to some extent. And you'd also be able to hear that they speak whatever language, even if they speak Portuguese because they're in Brazil. Fine, but you didn't land there. You weren't born there. You know, you came from abroad. Now you're coming into the United States illegally. And it's just not just illegally. There's also drug money and all kinds of stuff like that that's coming up the food chain. And nobody says a word. So, maybe I know too much and maybe I know too little. I'm just disgusted by the fact that we don't hear it.
I have the answer for us, and I think it's going to. Okay. I think we are all going to be okay because Kanye West is running for president in 2020, according to Twitter.
Oh, give me a break. I heard Trump say something to the effect of, "Well, he's just trying to work it out for the year 2024." Who knows? I mean, it'll be a sorry state of America if Kanye West. And then what do we have? Kim Kardashian West will be the first lady. Let me barf now.
I think it's going to solve everything. It's going to just make the world such a better place.
Oh, God. Well, I don't want to be in that world. I just don't
want
to
be there. We have to laugh at something. What a better way
to
end.
But you know what's so interesting? What's so interesting, what it tells me, how that informed me when he's considering running, is what he's doing is he's saying, I'm black, I have money, and I expect to get a lot of support from one segment of society, even though I have nothing between my ears other than to sing or do whatever the hell he does. And that's it. And is this the best we have? I don't think so. So I'm sorry to Kanye West or his wife. I'm not dissing them. They just don't have what it takes.
They do have the power. Unfortunately, we've given them cultural power, but I don't think that they should have as much political power as they're seeking right now. So, but if you have to have something to smile about in the middle of a horrible election season, in the middle of a pandemic, for goodness sakes, you got to have something to smile about.
Absolutely. It'll be very interesting to see where we go. Well, all right. Let's hope they stay healthy as well in case they are running. So wouldn't want them to be in harm's way of anything. So I wish them good health and continued wealth in order for them to be able to see their goal in life. Oh, God help me. The country's going to go to the crapper if that's the way it's going to go. I'm sorry.
Oh, boy.
Can you imagine in the tradition of George Washington? Well, you never know. If we're going to be taking down George and other people, or who knows, when are we going to take the statue down of Hamilton? And so that means even West is not going to be safe. I just hope that we don't put up a statue of him. Oh, God help him.
Don't get me started on statues, Hezzy. We'll be talking for another 2 hours.
All right. Just be well. And thanks so much. But before
thank
you go,
you so
there
much,
is somebody
Hezzy.
That's called in. And let me just see, the question may be for you, but bear with me a moment.
Oh.
Good morning, caller. Did you have a question or did you want to make a comment?
I just want to make a comment. You guys are laughing about Kanye, and I agree with you. However, isn't the current president of the Ukraine an ex-TV star?
Yes, he is. But you know,
and isn't our president also? I mean, he's a businessman, but he's also a TV star.
Well, I think
Kanye might actually have a chance. Kanye might have a chance.
He's going to have a good chance. He's going to have a good chance. I just don't know if that's going to serve the public. That's the only.
Oh, I totally agree. I'm just saying, don't discount it because.
I'm not.
We kind of discounted Trump.
Well, I wouldn't want to discount anybody at that point.
Caller, I have to agree with you, but I would also like to see a campaign website from Kanye. I think he needs a little bit. Needs a little bit of help.
Between Yaze and all the Kardashian cosmetic companies, I think they'll have a pretty hot campaign.
Yeah, they will.
Yeah. Yeah.
But we'll see what the gravitas is, or is it just because of the money? So are we buying an election? It's conceivable. Wouldn't be the first, let's face
it.
It
definitely won't be the last.
Maybe what we should do is outlaw movie stars. But then, where do you stop?
Okay,
thank
an entertaining
for
show.
Call.
Thank
what a pleasure. Be
thank
well.
You so much.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank
well,
you.
Well, how
Paula.
Exciting! That was very nice. Well, so Gabrielle, I want to thank you for engaging in the show. What a pleasure.
Thank
and,
you so much
we'll
as
go
always,
from
Hezzy.
There. Stay
have
well
a great
and stay
week.
Healthy. You too.
You too, sir.
Bye. Okay, well, there we are. Very, very exciting, and it was very nice of the caller to call. So that's very exciting as well. Well, let's take a gander and move on to some other things that are happening and around the world. This is very, very actually compelling. In a sense that there's a mystery of a lot of elephants that have died of all places in Botswana. I've been to Botswana, and I remember actually going out on the in the bush, and I was in shock when the guy that was driving the Land Rover that I was on, he said, "Look over there," and I remember looking in the direction that he pointed to. And he says, "Do you see the elephant?" I said, "What? I don't see an elephant." And it turns out I never realized that the color of the elephant, even with the tusks, is so camouflaged in the behind the trees. So it wasn't as it. I mean, you know, even a big tree is, I don't know, maybe 6 feet in circumference. Or 5 feet in circumference, whatever the sizes are. But the bottom line is the elephant is much bigger than that. And but the thing is that the gray of their skin tone is interesting because I couldn't see the elephant because of that. And at the end, when I was focusing on the direction of the guide, I saw the tusks. So it was the tusks that gave the elephant away in my mind. I was able to recognize it at that point, but not before. So interesting. Anyway, I think the capital of Botswana is Gaborone. Anyway, so the bottom line is nearly 400 elephants have been found dead in Botswana in recent weeks, but local authorities and wildlife experts are struggling to find an explanation with disease and poisoning among the possible causes. The reason for that is going to be explained. The reports of the deaths in the northern Okavango Delta region first began in early May, and since then, the government has confirmed 275 deaths. But the aerial surveys by wildlife group Elephants Without Borders have counted some 356 elephant carcasses. Well, poaching has been ruled out as a cause, and that's because the ivory has not been removed from the elephants. Infectious diseases as well as poisoning by farmers have also been considered, and samples from the elephants have been sent to labs in South Africa, Zimbabwe, and Canada for testing. So at this stage, it's difficult to really tell what could be the cause of the mortality. And Madi Rubin, head of veterinarian at the Botswana Department of Wildlife and National Parks, advised. We have eliminated from the local labs the possibility of anthrax being the cause of the mortality, but there are still a lot of infectious diseases and potentially other toxins that are still being investigated by the laboratory samples that have been collected. Well, the unexplained deaths have sparked concern among wildlife groups, with Botswana previously considered a safe haven for elephants. The country is home to almost a third of Africa's elephants, and although numbers are declining across the continent due largely to poaching, Botswana's elephant population has grown to 130,000 from 80,000 in the late 1990s. So concerned were they about this population of elephant. But elephants are seen as a growing nuisance by farmers whose crops have been destroyed by the animals, while last year the country's controversially lifted a five-year ban on elephant hunting. So very, very intriguing and very, very concerning, to say the least. Now, let's look. We're in Africa. We might as well stay in Africa. At least 30 villagers were massacred in central Mali in a terror attack. Oh, God. Unidentified armed men massacred 31 civilians in simultaneous attacks on several Mali villages this week, then killed 9 soldiers responding to the assault as violence surges in the country's conflict-racked center. An Islamist insurgency that erupted in the north of the vast West African country in 2012 has swept to its center, inflaming ethnic tension along the way. And clashes between the ethnic communities of Fulani, nomadic herders, and Dogon, those are traditional hunters, have increased in recent months, with community-based militias initially formed for defense now launching attacks. Now, armed uniformed men traveling in pickup trucks attacked 4 Dogon villages on Wednesday, one local official said by telephone, speaking on condition of anonymity for security reasons. The attack left at least 30 dead, including women, children, and the elderly, while others were missing, the official added. And from 3 to 9 p.m., nobody came to our rescue, said Yusuf Tisogu, an elder from Guari, one of the villages attacked. And deploring the army's inaction, he said, quote, "It is always late and never confronts the bandits, even if we tell them where they are," end quote. A senior government official called the attacks barbaric, quote unquote, and officials did not immediately blame any group. A military unit was dispatched to the area and helped bury 31 bodies on Wednesday. Army spokesman Colonel Diaran Kone advised Agence France-Presse. Well, on Thursday, it's always ahead of us. We're Wednesday, but it's already Thursday there. When it arrived at around 8 p.m., the village seemed deserted. There were practically no signs of life, he said. Just at the entrance, the FAMA, Malian Armed Forces, walked into an ambush, he said, adding that 9 soldiers were killed and 2 wounded. The attacks were not far from the village of Ogosoagu, and where 31 civilians were killed in February and 160 were butchered last year, all Fulbani. Unrest in central Mali has killed nearly 600 civilians this year. That's what the United Nations said last month. Mali's war erupted in 2012 when Tuareg rebels, supported by armed Islamists, took over the country's desert north. The rebels were then outmaneuvered by their Islamist allies, and the French military intervened to force them back. The conflict has since traveled south, as well as spilling into neighboring Burkina Faso and Niger, igniting a tinderbox of ethnic resentment and stoking fears for the future of the fragile nation. Armed groups coming from the north found fertile soil in an area riven by long-running land disputes, often between herders and farmers. Central Mali is now prey for tit-for-tat killings and routine jihadist attacks. Hundreds of thousands of people have been displaced. A jihadist group active in the region, led by radical Fulani preacher Amadou Koufa, has also increased suspicion of his ethnic group. In response to jihadists, traditional Dogon hunters have formed so-called self-defense groups, adding to the tension. More than 5,000 French troops, a regional G5 Sahel military cooperation deal with, and a United Nations peacekeeper mission in Mali have not been enough to contain the violence. It is absolutely driving the French crazy, that is for sure. So, let me just see one second. And this is interesting because we're still in Africa. We might as well stay there. And evidently, there are, we've learned that there are major suspected international money laundering schemes from Africa. Two NGOs, a non-governmental organization, published a damning report suggesting mining tycoon Dan Gertler could be evading U.S. sanctions in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Global Witness and the Platform to Protect Whistleblowers in Africa say there could be a possible international money laundering scheme involved in Cameroon. Health officials urge parents to vaccinate their children against measles, and it seems a deadly outbreak of the highly contagious disease has spread to 8 of the 10 regions there. A lot of stuff happening in Africa, that is for sure. Now, let's just move on. One moment here. I think you'll find this, you'll find this probably very interesting as well. Seems that Africa is suffering a locust plague, and there's now a new app launched to battle the swarms. So it seems that a vast number of locusts have been swarming across East Africa in recent months, devastating crops and threatening food security in the region. And now authorities are hoping a new app could help them gain the upper hand in their battle against the pests. Called E-Locusts, the app allows a team of locust scouts to track the swarms and provide real-time information on their size and location. I go look for locusts where they are. I report, I take pictures, I upload videos of their movement, and also advise them which kind of control can be used, Chilo Christopher, a locust scout in the Turkana region of northern Kenya, told Reuters. The information is logged in a central database and analyzed by technical teams who can then decide what action to take, including whether to spray pesticides either by plane or with ground teams. The app was launched by the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization in response to growing fears the locust infestations are threatening food security in the region. The current locust infestation is the worst that's been seen in for three generations, with unseasonably wet weather helping them to breed in greater numbers than usual. The locusts breed in the wet weather. Since late 2019, billions of the insects have ravaged crops in countries including Kenya, Somalia, Ethiopia, and spread into India, Pakistan, and the Red Sea region. An average locust swarm of around 40 million insects can travel up to 150 kilometers a day and consume enough food in that time to feed 35,000 people. So you can imagine the impact of such a happening. Unbelievable. Well, let's move on to the Middle East. So we have a little bit of time here to cover that. One second. I'm not sure. Let me just quickly look. Bear with me a moment. No, I think we mentioned this yesterday, the accident or question of a sabotage in the deadly explosion at Iran's Natanz nuclear site. I think we covered that yesterday. So, because that's when it came out. One second. That's where that is. Let's move on. Bear with me a moment. And one second. Let's move on here to our hemisphere. Evidently, Maduro has shuffled the military high command. And evidently, Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro has shuffled his military high command, but Defense Minister Vladimir Padrino Lopez, a general, kept his post. Maduro's political dominance in Venezuela is widely attributed to support from the military high command, which has allowed the socialist leader to resist sanctions pressure from the United States and a challenge to his authority from an opposition leader, Juan Guaido, who is backed by Washington. I decided, as always, on a partial ratification and a partial renovation of the incredible team of military leaders that run Venezuela's military high command, Maduro said, at a televised promotional ceremony late Tuesday. Maduro appointed Major General Domingo Hernandez Laez as the new army commander in place of Major General Alexis Rodrigo Cabello, the cousin of Diosdado Cabello, the president of the Constituent Assembly and widely considered the second most powerful man in Venezuela. Admiral William Cervantes Pinto, it replaced Admiral Giuseppe Alessandreo, a Navy commander, and Major General Jose Rafael Silva was promoted to head the Air Force, replacing Major General Pedro Juliac Latiguez. Padrino Lopez, 57, was kept as defense minister, a post he has held since 2014. So very, very interesting to say the least. And one second. Gonna have to move into some other segment here. One moment here. Yeah, let me just see. As long as we're here in the Americas, let's see what else we could do. And going back to what was mentioned earlier, Trump sees the Kanye West White House bid as a trial run for 2024. Seems as U.S. President Donald Trump said yesterday that Kanye West's declaration that he is running for president was very interesting, quote unquote, though he warned that the rapper should consider this as a trial run for 2024. Responding to West's claim that he would run against him, Trump told reporters at the White House he may. The declaration by West, a one-time Trump supporter, that he was gunning for the highest office in the land was retweeted 500,000 times and liked 1,000,000. Well, if he did it, he would have to view this as a trial run for what's going to happen in 4 years, said Trump, noting that it may be too late for West to register in some states and that he lacks the infrastructure for a presidential bid. West, who visited Trump in the Oval Office in 2018 and donned a trademark Make America Great Again red baseball cap, announced his proposed run on Saturday as the country celebrated Independence Day. We must now realize the promise of America by trusting God, unifying our vision, and building our future, the music and fashion mogul had said. I am running for president of the United States, he said, with an icon of a U.S. flag and the hashtag 2020 vision. He has not provided any details about his alleged campaign, and West, who previously said he would run in 2024, suggested in an interview with Forbes magazine that he no longer backed the U.S. president. I'm taking the red hat off with this interview, West told Forbes, referring to the trademark baseball cap. Like anything I've ever done in my life, I'm going to win, he said. Okay. So very, very interesting. And this is very interesting here from the United States as well. The FBI chief says that China is blackmailing dissenters in the United States to force them back home. Well, FBI Director Christopher Wray on Tuesday urged China-born people in the United States to contact the FBI if Chinese officials try to force them to return to China under a program of coercion that he said is led by Chinese President Xi Jinping. Wray issued the unusual appeal in an address to the Hudson Institute think tank, in which he reiterated U.S. charges that China is using espionage, cyber theft, blackmail, and other means as part of a strategy to replace the United States as the world's dominant economic and technological power. He said Xi has, quote, spearheaded, end quote, a program called Fox Hunt, aimed at strong-arming people born in China, living outside of the country, who are regarded as threats to return home in order to silence criticism of the Beijing political and human rights policies. Well, the families of those who refuse to return are threatened, and some have been arrested in China for leverage, he said. Hundreds of these Fox Hunt victims that they target live here in the United States, and many are American citizens or green card holders, he continued. Chinese government wants to force them to return to China, and China's tactics to accomplish this are shocking. And one second. Well, the Chinese embassy did not immediately respond to a request for comment on Ray's address. Beijing has denied U.S. charges that employs cyber espionage against the United States. Ray related a case in which he said the Chinese government sent an emissary, end quote, to visit a family in the United States of an unidentified target who could not be located. The emissary left a message that the target could choose between returning to China or committing suicide, Ray had said. I want to take this opportunity to note that if you believe the Chinese government is targeting you, that you are a potential Fox Hunt victim, please reach out to your local FBI office, he said. Ray also said that almost half of the nearly 5,000 active FBI counterintelligence cases now underway are related to China. Well, we've now reached a point where the FBI is opening new China-related counterintelligence cases about every 10 hours, Ray said in his address. So very, very compelling sort of stuff, that's to say the least. All right. And this is very interesting. This comes from Germany. Evidently, COVID-19 has exposed the limits of fact-denying populism, Merkel tells the European Parliament. I think we should play this for you, so bear with me a moment. Okay.
Pierre Benazet joins me now from Brussels. Pierre, why is Merkel outlining her country's program for the EU today?
Well, it usually is the case that the official launch, the formal launch, is obviously happening on the zero hour on the first day of the the semester. So you had the official end of it from Croatia to Germany on June the 30th at midnight. Ever since then, Germany is officially the incumbent, assuming the rotating presidency of the European Union for the next 6 months. But usually the formal start, the formal launch for the presidency is when the College of Commissioners, the European Commission, goes to the capital, in this case, goes to Berlin, in order to have all the talks, in order to start the presidency. And obviously, this year, this can't happen. So this trip, this Merkel trip to Brussels, marks the formal launch, and that's how she is how she's going to manage her presidency during the next 6 months and all. So this is starts today with the European Parliament, with the President of the European Commission, and with the President of the European Council, Charles Michel.
So what are Germany's priorities then for the next 6 months?
Well, the big one is what you heard during this short statement she made. Well, it was a long statement, obviously, at the European Parliament. The coronavirus response is going to shape the German presidency for the coming 6 months. Obviously, she calls for solidarity, and it's not a word that should be taken in vain in this context. It means that the Europeans have to find a solution for the stimulus package that they have decided, which amounts to 750 billion euros, and they have to decide next week at the European Council, which takes place at the end of next week. They also have to decide on the oncoming multi-annual financial framework, which could, well, which should encompass around 1 trillion euros. And, you know, there is still this fight between the frugal four countries like Netherlands or Denmark, for instance, who do not want to pay as much as the other ones want. Germany being a focal point there because it has accepted to have a joint borrowing in order to finance the 750 billion package. So this is going to be a very tough debate next week. It's been ongoing for the past 2 years, but now there is the coronavirus response, which adds up to the difficulties. And among other things, she wants obviously a greener Europe. She wants a digitized Europe. And she also laments that there will be probably a no-deal Brexit, and also that Europe has to be at the forefront of a new multilateral world, because the departure of the United States, for instance, from the World Health Organization is a serious setback for the world.
Wow, okay. So is that the situation there? And bear with me a moment as we move on to some other issues and other concerns. One moment. This is interesting because France has ruled out a total lockdown in case of a COVID-19 resurgence or a surge. The French government said Wednesday was girding for a possible surge in coronavirus cases in coming months, but would not respond to any new outbreak with another nationwide lockdown. My aim is to prepare France for a possible second wave while preserving our daily life, our economic and social life, new Prime Minister Jean Castex said in an interview with RTL Television. But we're not going to impose a lockdown like the one we did last March, because we've learned that the economic and human consequences from a total lockdown are disastrous, he said. Instead, any business closures or stay-at-home orders would be targeted to specific areas, he said. The coronavirus is still here, Castex had warned, adding that he would travel on Sunday to France's South American territory of French Guiana, which is reeling from a surge in cases. Officials reported 124 new cases in the territory on Tuesday, bringing the total to nearly 5,200, and the government has dispatched dozens of health workers from the mainland as well as a field hospital. Well, the head of France's National Health Agency, Jérôme Salomon, said that authorities were anticipating a second wave of COVID-19 cases this autumn or this winter, depending on a seasonal impact that remains uncertain. What we have to understand is that the epidemic's resurgence will basically depend on our behavior, he said, in an interview with French newspaper Le Figaro. Well, even as millions of people prepare to relax over the autumn holiday seasons, Salomon urged continued social distancing and the use of face masks, especially in crowded places and indoors. France called its two-month lockdown on May 11, setting out their principles behind the government's action. In a speech on April 28, Castex's predecessor, Edouard Philippe, emphasized that we will have time to live with the virus. He handed or he hailed the lockdown by pointing to a study suggesting that confinement prevented 70,000 deaths in France, adding that its, quote, positive effects outweighed its negative effects, end quote. Story there. Bear with me a moment because we'll see what else is happening on the front stage. A moment. Missed this before. Evidently, China has transformed a Hong Kong hotel into its new security agency headquarters. Well, China on Wednesday opened a new office for its intelligence agents to operate openly in Hong Kong for the first time under a tough new security law, transforming the hotel into the force's headquarters. The new base is a hotel overlooking the city's Victoria Park, a location that has hosted pro-democracy protests for years, including an animal vigil each June, marking Beijing's deadly Tiananmen Square crackdown. A plaque bearing the security agency's name was unveiled early on Wednesday in front of the Hong Kong Guidance and City on the Level broadcast show. Okay. So let me just quickly see if there's anything else here. I think so. We're fine. I think that that's it. I'm going to look one more time. Just make sure that we've caught up with as much as possible. All right. One second here. 1 minute. I want to check if there's anything that's come out of the business world before we let you go. No, I think we're okay on that front as well. All right, so I want to thank you for all being with us. Tomorrow is Thursday, and let me just quickly look to see who we have scheduled for tomorrow. Bear with me a moment here. 1 second. Let me see if I can get this. 1 minute, because I don't know where to find this right now. I think I have it now. Okay, tomorrow's Thursday, so we're going to speak to... Sorry, that's the wrong date. 1 minute here. Okay. Okay, tomorrow's Thursday. So tomorrow's the 9th. Yeah. Okay, we have, very interestingly enough, we have Laurie and John Wiles, who are going to talk about the Toyota Land Cruiser. Really, really fascinating, to say the least. And then we're going to be speaking to Dorothy Mazzarella. She's the Vice President of Government Relations, a special counsel that can give you best practices at no cost to advise how to reopen buildings that were once office buildings or stuff that has been languishing over the 3 months or so breakdown in our normal standards, the old normal. So the point is we need to reopen, and we'll be able to get guidance from her. And which is really fascinating. It's the ICC. They are known all over the world, and they've got offices all over the world. Let me just quickly look to see if I think it may have already unfurled on my website. I'm not sure. I'm really not sure. Bear with me a second and see if it's up already. There's so much that's in advance. Yeah, well, we definitely know about the Land Cruiser. It's the 2020 Toyota Land Cruiser Heritage Edition four-wheel drive SUV V8. So that's already online, so you'll be able to read about that. And, oh, yes, and we do have notice about the broadcast. So let me just see. Yeah, it's called the International Code Council, and they've compiled a guide of safety precautions and considerations for businesses. I think you'll find it very interesting, and we'll talk to her about that. In the last half hour, we'll cover whatever local news we can get to in a timely manner. So that's the story. We hope you'll consider joining us tomorrow. And let me go back to our studio screen and just wish you a good day. Take care. Goodbye. 1 second.